So when I got the phone call from Megan asking if I would give this talk, it was May 24th, which was the 26th anniversary of my graduation from the Naval Academy. It's also the Feast of Our Lady of Ransom, and I do feel that she has ransomed me. So I just wanted to point out, since I graduated 26 years ago, for the high school girls, if you do the math, I'm 48. And I know this is an important question to high school girls, because I heard that they were asking Sister Elizabeth how old she was. And they said, are you 20? Says, how do you know I'm not 40? And I said, well, maybe Sister Claire, I think Sister Claire is 40. And the other, and one of the high school girls said, now, yes, wasn't she in the Civil War or something? So I just wanted you to know, I'm only 48. So the original question was, how did I get from being a Marine to being a religious sister? It's a good question. It has everything to do with my conversion to Catholicism. When I converted, I was not just going to become a woman who happened to be Catholic. I had to become a Catholic woman. And what I hope you take away from this is that God is all powerful. He can use any circumstances to direct a soul to himself. He can call anyone to a vocation. So the first question is, how did I end up in the Marine Corps to begin with? I grew up in a home that was as happy as a home could be without the faith. My father was a believer. My mother an agnostic. And neither of them had any use for organized religion. They had, unfortunately, both had very bad experiences from bad examples of Catholics. And so Catholicism especially, and for my mother growing up in Worms, which was in Germany, which was the epicenter of Lutheranism, was not inclined to be favorable towards Catholicism or any other form of organized religion. However, they were old school. And if we had a religion as a family, I would say it was good citizenship to be a patriot, to be honest, to work hard, to be involved with the community. And they were very involved in keeping up with politics and current events. And my father spoke to me a great deal at the table, the kitchen table, about these current events. From my father, I learned specifically, I would say his greatest legacy to us, my sister, and I have one older sister, was to do what you think is right, regardless of what other people think. My father did not care at all about what people thought about him. And he would tell me when I would start whining, he would say, well, what do you care? And he would lecture me in the car. He would, it's one of my fondest memories of him, and we would be driving somewhere, and he'd give me lectures about how to be a useful and good citizen of the United States, you know, to be productive, and he'd have his fingers on the dashboard like this to make his points to me. When I was 8 or 10, he gave me a copy of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I only read a few chapters of this book. My sister actually read it cover to cover, and I found out at his funeral that she said she was really impressed by this book. It actually explained to her, before you give a correction to someone else, to remember your own human frailty. And now I'd wished I'd read it earlier in my life. It's actually a very good point of natural virtue. From my mother, I learned the spirit of self-sacrifice. My mother was and is always doing things for other people. And I never heard her complain about her duties as a wife and mother. She was a Brownie leader when I was a little girl and I was in the Brownie troop. And she even took us camping. And if you knew my mother's an artist. And it's just the most unlikely person you could imagine camping. And she took us camping. I mean, she's claustrophobic. But she took us camping. And I thought that was heroic of her. And she gave me some of the best discipline I had at home. I have very strong memories of my father talking about his army days. And so my path towards the military started from a very early age. He loved being in the army. And he would march me around the house and he'd say, left, right, left, right. And I would laugh and laugh. I'd march. I loved it. I wore his Eisenhower jacket to school, his army hat I wore to school all the time. And he would take us to air shows, and we lived near McGuire Air Force Base. And there were these young people in uniform, not much older than I was. And I thought, Dad, what are they? They're in the Air Force uniform. I could be a kid in the Air Force. I don't know what it was. The smell of the jet fuel, the stark simplicity of the buildings. From when I was 6 or 8 years old, something called to me about the Air Force Base. I still get shivers when I drive by Fort Riley. And so this was left an impression on me, and I did eventually join the Civil Air Patrol. That's what those little kids were doing. And my mother, we were an aviation family. My father was a pilot. He taught himself aerobatics from a cartoon book. We found it after he died. It was a book of cartoons of how to do the aerobatics, and he taught himself from that. He would take us on family vacations. He and his brother owned a small grass strip airport. Aviation was our life. And my mother even learned how to fly. She learned how to solo, so take 3 takeoffs and landings by herself, just in case something happened to my father when we were flying. I mean, that is devotion. They grew up poor, my mother and father. I mean, we were fairly well off, but my parents had a very strong sense of being resourceful and frugal. And they wanted us to be resourceful and frugal and to solve problems for ourselves, and they taught us that. They wanted us to have the opportunities they did not have because they grew up poor, and that meant college. And so they were determined for my sister to go to college and for me to go to college. And the focus was, or the goals for us were really success in material endeavors and involvement in the community. To be successful was to be comfortable and to have the things that they didn't have. And while they were both conservative, they did believe that women should not be denied an opportunity just because they were women. They believed that if a woman could do something and she wanted to do it, she should be able to do it. More on that later. What was my own perspective? My idea of what I was supposed to be as a girl. As a little girl, I thought the only point in being a girl was to dress up in dresses and have people tell me that I look pretty. But for someone, for me, dolls were okay, but pop guns were better. And dresses were just awful. And I had the neighbor boy was the only young child in town. So we played cops and robbers, and it was much more fun than playing house for me. So, and I rebelled against girl things because I thought boys had all the fun. As I got older, this idea of what I should be developed further from television and movies. I lived in a little bit of my own Hollywood world, you know, watching certain shows and following the actors. And we all did this in my school, my friends and I, we were following the actors, and those were the people we idolized and thought we should be like. I read Seventeen magazine. I could only value myself in as much as I was hot. Now, the thing is, that's really difficult when you have the personality of someone who really only stands hot as a temperature. And also that I could only value myself in as much as I did everything that the boys did and just as well as they did it. So this is an interesting scenario, isn't it? I have to be hot and I have to do everything the boys do and put that all together. At school, I was influenced by materialism and liberal ideas. I became an environmentalist for a while and imbibed a lot of these ideas that were maybe not quite right, but it's in the atmosphere. Thankfully, my conservative upbringing still held the upper hand. And it got me through that part. But this was where I developed at school the idea that maybe my parents didn't really know what they were doing. And I know part of that is part of adolescence. but there was something in the atmosphere that maybe mom and dad, they just weren't that smart. I learned much better later. And in school, math and science gave me answers. In English, only left me with questions. History kind of basically told me the depravity of mankind, because, you see, English in a non-Catholic school is really just about talking about books and how you feel about these books. And the choices of these books varied from generally accepted classics to politically driven trash. And when I say, how does it make you feel? I don't say it's about the interpretations that are justified, various interpretations that are true that you get in a good book. Letting the book, the beauty of the language, speak to you. It was just an agenda. And I didn't like English. This is going to come back to haunt me later. Okay. And I was looking for something more tangible. I do remember being a junior, standing in the hall in the public high school, asking myself, why am I here? And I had to do the logic. I went to grade school to get into high school. I went to high school to get into college. I'm going to college to get a job. I'm getting a job so I can have a big house and be successful. And then I'm going to die. And that's the end. And that wasn't enough. And it wasn't just then, but even earlier, that I was looking for a purpose. At the age of 13, I thought maybe a tennis pro. Because I wanted fame. There's a purpose. Fame, like all the tennis players. I'm going to be famous. Well, we had a meeting with the coaches, and they said, I think by the time you're 16, you can do it. So this was the summer, and every summer from the time I can even remember, 7 years old, I played tennis all summer long, 8 hours a day. Do you ever wonder when you're older how you actually were able to do that? It was 95 degrees. Well, so I got started, and suddenly everything changed to me. Really, outwardly, nothing changed. It was the same procedure. It was the same tennis camp. But there was all this pressure. I had to perform. I had to achieve. And within a month, I was practically out of my mind. I actually had to leave the camp and spend a week with my sister. I put it aside because I did not want to eat, sleep, drink, breathe tennis for the rest of my life. So I did look around to the school for heroes. I found them. I had a number of teachers I admired. I was a bass player. I played in the orchestra. I played in pit orchestra. And I thought, I want to be a music teacher. Be a music teacher. I brought that idea home to mom and dad. And they said, you want to be a music teacher? How about a lawyer? And I know they feared maybe I wouldn't get a job. I know that. I'm sure parents have ambitions for their children. But I respected them enough to look for something else. And I walked around for a while actually saying, I'm going to be a corporation lawyer. I actually didn't know what that meant. But I knew I'd have a lot of money and I could fly a King Air and have a Jaguar 1986 XJ6. But then that faded away, and I thought, well, maybe the first woman president. So we apparently was into politics. This was appealing to my father. And every good president needs military experience. And that really actually started my journey towards the Naval Academy. And TV and movies influenced me a great deal. My parents did restrict what I watched, the time, but I wasn't restricted from watching television. So I watched every military show I could find, no matter how ridiculous it was. McHale's Navy, Gomer Pyle, MASH, Private Benjamin, Tour of Duty, China Beach. And some of these were about women, as you know. Not to mention all the war movies we watched with mom and dad. So where was religion in all of this? As I said, our family had really no use for organized religion. I was told I could choose my own religion. And it's not that my parents were against it. As I said, my father was a believer. But I did ask to go in first or second grade to CCD with my classmates because that's what they were doing. In public school, you could actually have Catholic catechism afterwards at that time. And mom and dad said, no. My best friend's mother was killed in an accident when we were in second grade. And we were at the funeral and she genuflected and she's my best friend. So I'm going to genuflect. My mother stopped me. She said, we don't do that. So I got the idea. Maybe this is not the direction I'm maybe not meant to take or why. But at 8 years old, I had a great fear of dying. I remember crying in my room and I told my mother, I don't want to die. I'm afraid to die. Because what's going to happen after? There's nothing afterwards. I'm just going to die. And she said, you know, you're eight. It's okay. Don't think about this. But she couldn't provide an answer. And really later in life, I believed that religion was meant and to help people who couldn't face dying. And really, if you challenge most people who don't have beliefs, that's where they're going to be hung up. What happens when you die? That's it. It was really my grandmother. She took me to church. We used to call her grandmother. I call it grandmother great. My grandmother was amazing. There was a church within walking distance. And she took me there. And it was truly Reverend Hope who would give the sermon. And then he'd send us downstairs for children's hour. And while the adults got the sermon, the rest of the sermon, and we'd have the classes downstairs. And when I got home, I said, hey, Mom and Dad, can I go to church? I don't know why. There was another Methodist church right down the street from us. So my father would take me and drop me off. And I would go to the Sunday school classes there in the basement. And however, my understanding of what religion was just about a bunch of men who wore striped garb. Because I only saw the books where it was just a bunch of men in stripes. So I didn't really understand what religion was. My exposure to sisters, we had poor Claire's in the neighborhood. And I saw them at the grocery store and I, you know, just like every kid does to me now, Mom, what are those? And she says, those are Catholic sisters. And the tone of her voice, the reserve, indicated to me there was something not right. And of course, I saw Sister Act and The Sound of Music. And so my general impression was that sisters were kind of a little bit stiff and they needed to lighten up a little bit. And I did some church hopping, but I didn't really see a lot of difference between any of the religions. So maybe the Baptists sang more, I felt. But by 10th grade, I was an atheist. And I made fun of my friend who believed in creation. She said that God made the earth. And we were in chemistry class. I remember the classroom. We were there. And I, oh, sure. I mean, that's so easy, isn't it? God made it. That's just so simple. I mean, it's way more complicated than that. You can't be serious. And it was at that same time I started to look at the Air Force Academy. It was my freshman year. I got the senatorial nomination. I had all the checks in the box. I could not do a pull-up. Not one pull-up. And I lifted weights. I took the weight training class in gym, and I still could not do a pull-up. So in the meantime, believe it or not, this same friend that I made fun of invited me to play in her church band at their Saturday night service, the rock band. I didn't know how controversial this was. I didn't really care about religion. I just wanted to play in a rock band. Christian rock, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. I was going to play in a rock band. So I brought my bass guitar. Actually, I borrowed the school, so I didn't even have my own. And I played the bass guitar in a Christian rock band every Saturday night. The first night I went, though, the preacher gave a sermon. I don't actually remember what it was about. But something struck me. Maybe there is something real about this. And I started to go because I wanted to go, not just to play in the band. And so I heard at the Naval Academy, you don't have to do a pull-up. You just have to hang on a bar for about 12 seconds. That was actually really hard. And so I lifted weights and I tried to lose a couple pounds and I made it exactly to 12 seconds, and I got in. I barely got in, but I got in. And it was suggested to me to do the preparatory school ahead of time, to take a year, get yourself ready, get your academics ready. Oh, well, like about every adolescent, I am driven. I am goal-oriented. I must get on with my life. I'm going right in. And so I started Plebe Summer. I hadn't really worked out. What a nightmare. Okay. The running was pretty hard. Obstacle course was also very hard. And I was so homesick. It was awful. So I don't want to quit, but all right, I'm ready for some guidance. And I asked my upperclassmen, sir, I'm homesick. Can I speak to the chaplain? Take me to the chaplain. Well, the Catholic priest. And I said, oh no. A woman hater. And I sat in his office, and it was very dark in there. And he was very stern. He didn't smile. And the upshot of it was, buck up, little camper, go on your way. You mean you're not going to pray over me or anything? No. And so that was it. I left. So that was not very satisfying. But what about the Naval Academy? It was co-ed by room. So the women, we had a shower and a sink in the room, and the toilets were down the hall. But the men were living next door. And this resulted in some interesting experiences, such as drunken upperclassmen breaking into our room and singing three rounds of You Lost That Loving Feeling. Now, we've been told men and women are all the same, except a few physical differences. But I don't think they would have sang that to the boys. There was a lot of fraternization, meaning inappropriate relationships between upperclassmen and underclassmen. And you know, I had two attractive blonde roommates, and there were always boys in the room. There was nothing, I assure you, they were good girls. Okay, but they were there. And they got a lot of attention, and it was constant. I had to take wrestling. They called it combative grappling. It was wrestling. And the worst part of it was that this was in a building where the tourists could walk above you in a glass window area around this track and watch you take the wrestling. And I always got paired up, because I'm tall, with the most aggressive girl in our class. And most of us actually really didn't care for it. We just sort of acted it out to get ourselves the A's. There were certain moves you had to do. This girl, she just wanted to beat me up. And she usually succeeded. The men's fencing team was canceled to make money for the women's rugby team. I found that there were four types of girls there. There were man-haters. Every man is evil. Everything they do is wrong. They're all out to get me. I hate them. I'm going to be a man. I'm going to spit on the ground. I'm going to use the foul language. And I'll say we all picked that up. Okay, but some people were worse than others. The girls who felt they had to have loose morals to be accepted by the men. And I would say a fairly significant majority of the girls who actually just wanted to be there and do this because this is what they wanted to do, and they thought they could. But we were always in a position of proving we could, of proving. I'm going to prove this because I'm going to do this particular activity just the way you do. There was always the pressure to prove. And if something happened to you, to kind of not say anything, because you don't want to be one of those women that make the claim that something happened. Okay. I was actively involved in the Protestant Midshipman Club at the chapel. I was an acolyte. It was an Episcopal service. And I was there trying to get a purpose-driven degree. I didn't even know really what I wanted to major in. I just wanted the degree so I could graduate from the Naval Academy. And eventually I picked English. Now, you know, I don't like English. But I have to say, I did have some good, there were good professors there. But I knew I could graduate if I took English. Okay, so, thankfully, I didn't really bother reading a lot of the books, because a lot of them were trash. Now, like I said, there were a number of excellent professors there. I did argue with a professor once. I got in a disagreement with him about a book, and he ended the whole lecture by telling me I was unenlightened. Shakespeare. Now, I had started this rather late, so I had to take Shakespeare. Thankfully, it was still mandatory at the Naval Academy. And I applied for Dr. White's class, and I did not get it. And I had a professor who had an agenda. The first 2 weeks, I just chomped on my teeth, and I took it. But when he said Shakespeare was gay, and he wrote the sonnets for a little boy, that was it. I dropped the class. I couldn't take it. And I told one of my classmates, I said, I don't know how you're going to do it. He said, I'm staying in it. I've got to get this done. I said, I don't know how you're going to do it. I said, I'm not doing it. And now I'm a junior, so I have precedence. And I said, I want Dr. White's English class. My roommate, who's a math major, took this class, and she has an elective, and she says, you've got to take it. You've got to take this class. You have to take this class. Okay. So I signed up for it, and I went in on the first day, and the class was packed. There were no empty seats. It was maybe a 40 person classroom. And the midshipman sitting next to me was giving up his free time. There were several midshipmen giving up their free hours to sit on all these classes. Dr. White walks in, and there's a big round of applause. And he spent the entire first class dissecting the line, "She doth teach the torches to burn bright." And I walked out of the class, and I turned to the midshipman that had been sitting in on it next to me, and I said, it can't mean all that. He says, no, wait. He does it with everything. He does it with everything. And he did. We were starving for this. All of us were starving for this. Now, his method of teaching there is very different from what you hear in his lectures to the seminary. And he would disappear from time to time. We'd be watching a movie of a Shakespeare play. Now I know where he was. Okay, he was at the seminary. But it was a different method. But he would speak to us about God when it was in the literature. And it was there because it's Shakespeare. And I'd been interested in Catholicism. Now, I'd heard that he's a Catholic, and I thought, well, I'll look into it a little bit. And I'd been impressed by the midshipman who made the sign of the cross at supper, or at lunch. Now, I thought, well, maybe I'll look into it a little bit. I took a second elective from Dr. White. This was Shakespeare's romantic plays. I know we did Cymbeline and The Tempest, some other plays. And here was the turning point. He said, and I don't know what it was in reference to, but he said, you know, there is a right and wrong. And you can say that. And we were flabbergasted because we've been conditioned that there's no right and wrong. You can say what you want. You can think what you want about literature. You know, everyone needs to do what they need to do that makes them happy. And you need to do what makes you happy. And you can't say that that's what they're doing is wrong. But it was the big moment of grace that there is a right and wrong, and we can say that. Later in another lecture, he talked about intercession. And I know he made a reference to the Blessed Mother, or I think that, because after I asked him what he meant by intercession, I didn't understand that. So I'm not really sure where you got that from, but you know, if your dad's kind of being ornery and your mom just looks at him and goes, that's intercession. Okay. He made another comment about people going to clubs, these dance clubs, because they're really seeking beauty, these adult clubs. That baffled me. Seeking beauty. How is somebody seeking beauty? And it took me years. I didn't get the seeking beauty. But he's trying to plant seeds, to seek beauty, to seek the truth, to believe that there's a right and wrong. Well, I thought maybe this Catholic thing isn't so bad. And I asked the Catholic chaplain for a rosary. And I started, and I had to, you know, I had the pamphlet, the first joyful mystery. You had to say it right. Hail Mary, full of grace. the Lord is with thee. And after saying the rosary, I thought, all right, how can they say that the Catholic Church is down on women when I know that this is one of their most treasured prayers and it's all honoring the Mother of God? How can they say that they're down on women? I know no Protestant church I ever went to said anything about the Blessed Virgin Mary and paid her any attention whatsoever. And there it is. So I started praying the rosary. Well, eventually got into a crisis. And Dr. White sent me over to Lieutenant Childs, then Lieutenant Childs. And he talked to me and gave me a catechism, a Baltimore Catechism number 3. It's a photocopy. The one with the blue cover. Okay. And I read it. And I opened the book and I opened it up. It said, what is the meaning of life? I thought, it's going to be good. And it said, to know, love, and serve God in this life and be happy with him in the next. I said, one sentence? We used to spend hours and hours pondering over what the meaning of life is. Why am I here? What is the purpose of my existence? That's amazing. Turned the next page, read another question, and there's an answer. And another page, and there's a question, and there's an answer. You don't have to believe the answers, but there are answers. And they are the answers. So I went to Catholic Mass on the Yard, and I heard the homily. Okay? And I thought, wow, this isn't just, you know, maybe Protestantism plus. This is different. This is not what I'm accustomed to at all. So it was time to graduate. Why the Marine Corps? Only a very small percentage of midshipmen actually go into the Marine Corps. I had zero interest in the Marine Corps when I went to the Naval Academy. They were way too gung-ho for me. Right? But I liked all the Marines on the Yard that I met. They were very frank, and I might say brutally honest. Marines are not known for their tact. So I had to go into the fleet, and I actually asked permission to go to both. I wanted to go into the Navy for a month and into the Marine Corps for a month because I needed to make the decision. I needed to take a look. And I happened to go onto a ship whose captain, and I have to sanitize what he said, but his motto, the captain of the ship, they're all awful and they're all out to get you. And the ship morale reflected that. They say that a unit takes on the characteristics of its leader. And this was true. So it just happened to be I had kind of not a great experience. The unit I was put with, the navigation team, they were fabulous. But the atmosphere on the ship, there was something that just didn't sit right. And I wanted to be a pilot. I really didn't want to be on a ship, even though, you know, I'd have to be on a carrier, okay, but I'm going to fly in the air. So I went to the Marine Corps the next month, and what I found there were a bunch of happy-go-lucky, crazy people. And I said, I think I can do this. And I went after the pilot billet, and after clearing up some medical issues, I got it. Now, I am scheduled to be one of the first 10 women pilots in the Marine Corps, because in 1994, they opened up the combat exclusion, and I could fly. And I'm ready. I reported to the basic school in June. This is 6 months of infantry training. And they don't want all the academy grads in one company, so guess who had to wait 2 months? And, you know, that old pull-up came back to haunt me. I couldn't get up the rope on the obstacle course. And so all the other midshipmen got to go to the basic school, go on temporary duty. And I had to stay in the barracks. I had absolutely nothing to do. It was boring. So I decided I'm going to write the great American novel. And I started researching characters. Now, I knew Dr. White had written a book called The Mouth of the Lion. And being completely ignorant, I went to Barnes & Noble thinking I could pick it up there. And they said, no, we don't have that, but we can order it for you. Okay, great. And I also picked up a book there. I went through the Catholic section, and I found this book called Catholicism and Tradition. I said, well, I knew this word tradition has something to do with Dr. White. Let's find out what this is all about. So I read that book and I got to a line about a third of the way through that said, any religion that interferes with the affairs of a man is a false religion. I said, that's backwards. I closed the book and I said, I think I get it. Whatever he's after, I think I get it. August 15th, 1996, I went to my first traditional Catholic Mass. I got lost. That shouldn't surprise any of the sisters. So I got there and I opened the door, and the first thing that struck me is nobody looked at me. Because, you know, in a Protestant church, when you open the door, everybody wants to see who's coming in. Nobody looked at me, and there were bells ringing. And whatever was going on looked very serious. And all the women had something on their head, and I don't have that. So I shut the door. And I went and I sat on the steps. And I waited, and Lieutenant and Mrs. Childs came out, and they took me to supper. And we had a talk. But I still wanted to make sure. I went to the Novus Ordo in Annapolis, the whole Mass, to see what was really going on. Now, I was Episcopalian at this point, essentially. And high church. Okay. So I went to this Novus Ordo Mass, and at the consecration, there was the consecration of the host, and I did believe in transubstantiation in a very elementary form. I really didn't get it, but then everyone turned to each other and passed the peace. That's what we called it. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they turn around and shake hands and peace be with you and peace be with you. Wait, whoa. We're in the middle of the consecration. And then they went back and consecrated the chalice. And I thought, okay, this Novus Ordo thing, no. I'm either going to be a traditional Catholic or I'm going to stay Episcopalian. I'm not doing this because I'm not going to leave something just to go back to it. And so I started the basic school, and I'll explain a little bit what happened there. But in the beginning of September, I was thrown into a state of emotional turmoil, something that happened to some people that I know. Okay. An unfortunate incident, and the delicate shoot of my newfound faith was just about trampled. And I decided I'm going to go home for the weekend. It was right after Labor Day. It was the weekend after Labor Day, and I went on my way home. I was exhausted because it was Friday night, and I had been in the field or doing field exercises during that whole week. And so I stopped at on the Eastern Shore at home of some elderly Dutch people who were from church. And I had no clothes. I had no extra things because all my extra things were at home, toothbrush, everything. Okay. But I went out on the rocks and I looked out over the Chesapeake Bay. Religion. No, it was all a lie. It's all a lie. How can this be? How could this have happened to these people? And it was back and forth and back and forth. And finally, the little light was, look, just because people don't follow the Ten Commandments, it's not God's problem. Okay. It's not the church's problem. It's that person's problem. The church is the church. The Ten Commandments are the Ten Commandments. Keep that separate. Okay. I think I get it. Next morning at 8 o'clock, I got up and I started driving home. And it all started again. There's no God. This is all a lie. There's no God. No. There's a God. There is a God. There is a God. I'm going to do this. I'm going to convert. I'm going to join the church. Maybe I'll even try a religious vocation. Maybe I'll try it. About 10 minutes later, a Chevy 1500 pickup truck pulled out in front of me. I was doing 64 miles an hour. I slammed into him. And when it came to a stop, I didn't know where I was. I knew it was bad because there was just a lot of smoke in the car. And the horn of the car was just going off. It wouldn't stop. It was just going off. And I got out of the car and I was dazed. And there was no front end. There was nothing left. Now, I was fine, but I had to be life-flighted to Baltimore shock trauma because of the amount of damage on both of the vehicles. And my parents came down the next day. We went to the junkyard to get everything out. And they said, my father was very quiet. He said, that mangled piece of metal is your car. And to me, I said, that was the period on the end of the sentence. I just walked away. So what do we do? 6 months of mandatory infantry officer training. Now, as I'd said, the combat exclusion was lifted in 1994. And so women used to be in their own platoon at the basic school, but now we were integrated with the men. And this meant I, for one exercise, shared a foxhole with the men, did offensive and defensive tactics. Now, to point out, the motto of the Wounded Marine used to be free a man to fight. So we would fill roles that were support roles, that were administrative roles, that were non-combat roles, to help to allow the men to go into the combat roles. But that was gone. And in fact, the women were told no longer even to wear makeup. There used to be very specific makeup regulations for women, okay, to be professional. But it was gone. So that was the first step, no makeup. Okay, that had just happened. So offensive, defensive tactics, ground assaults, air assaults, amphibious assaults, I mean, just like D-Day. Penetrating razor wire, day and night patrols, ambushes, calling for artillery, shooting weapons, throwing hand grenades, land navigation. Yes, I got lost. Conditioning hikes up to 20 miles with full combat gear, hand-to-hand combat with and without weapons, running over terrain in uniform, out of uniform. Not a place for me to develop my ladylike tendencies. Now, while women did excel in some areas, okay, I really only knew one woman who could do everything. There was at one point where I had to carry 120 pounds of gear, and we walked a mile. And now, usually after a mile, when you're on a conditioning hike, you sit, stop to adjust the gear. And so I sat down and I said, I'm not gonna be able to get up. Well, thankfully, we didn't know it wasn't conditioning hike. We were at our location to start this exercise. The other conditioning hikes, the men had a combat load, and I am not kidding, the women's load was a towel and a sewing kit. Now, yes, this is a slap in the face, right? Okay, now we're all, I'm going to prove. So we took the men's load. We're going to carry the men's load. But most of the girls actually could not even carry the towel and sewing kit. Most of us were actually bruises from head to toe. The gear didn't fit us, okay? The flak jackets didn't fit us right. Everything we went over gave us a bruise. Personally, I was proud of the bruises, all right? But we were one bruise from head to toe. And we had to do a lengthy assault carrying a full combat load. And we were running through the woods, and you know, it's just like movies. You go up and you go down, and you go up and you go down, and it's, you leapfrog. And my roommate came next to me. This is a different roommate now, right? Roommate from the barracks, Marine roommate. And she says, aren't you glad you carried your towel and sewing kit? And I said, yeah. So at this point, I was given a book that was about flowers and virtues by Father Lassance for girls. Yeah, that one, I had to be honest, I couldn't stand it. I went, what is this? I can't do this. I mean, I really wanted to, but you can't, really? So what was I supposed to be like? What am I supposed to do now? What am I supposed to do? And I started to awaken a little bit more that maybe there was actually a legitimate reason why women were not permitted to be in combat. And it might even be a noble reason. In hand-to-hand combat, I was paired up with a male lieutenant for training. Okay. Now, it was a little bit different at this time. I was... But it involved receiving full force kicks to the face, which were blocked by your arm, which means that this lieutenant had to kick my arm full force, which he did because he has to pass. And I had bootlace marks all down my arm. My arm was swollen to the twice its size. And of course, all of the other lieutenants made fun of him for beating up on a girl. And naturally so. And he was humiliated. And my thought was, if we want to be treated with respect and with dignity, is this the way to do it, to insist that men kick us in the face and bruise us? For my test for hand-to-hand combat, my partner was literally the size of Father Mouché. And I said, listen. Would you mind just falling down for me because I need an A? And he says, oh, no problem. I knew him from before, so we were acquaintances. And he said, that's no problem. I'll be happy to do that. And I had to pull out the animal. All womanhood put aside, I had to get this grade. I think I even drooled on myself. and I threw him to the ground, and he did a great job. And I stomped on it, pretended to stomp on his head, which was right next to his head with the heel of my boot. And then it was my turn. Now, I don't know if you've ever been thrown around by somebody the size of Father Mouché. All I have to say, it was very painful. I was a rag doll. For a live fire exercise, I couldn't keep up with the sprinting. We did do real bullets once. And I was falling further behind in this sprint. And I don't know how it happened, but the lieutenant that was in front of me dropped to the ground right in front of me. And how I didn't shoot him in the back of the head to this day, I don't know. It just happened so quickly. I missed. The obstacle course, it didn't matter how much I lifted weights. There was a woman's side that had little like props on it. So there's a little beam on top that you could help you to jump over the obstacles. Okay. And I could do that side eventually. I could never do the men's side. And I really believed if I'm doing this, I need to do what they do. And I couldn't. And I lifted weights to the point where at one point I was teased about being Xena the warrior goddess. And it wasn't a compliment, okay? And pugil sticks. It was hand-to-hand combat with a stick with pads on it. And you've probably seen this in an old movie somewhere where they go up with hockey gear and they beat each other up with this. Well, the men, it's very exhilarating to watch this. They swing the things around and they get each other on the ground. Well, then the women go up there and you can't really do it. You know, we're trying to swing it around. We just can't do it. And thankfully for that, they pitted us against other women because there would have been some serious injuries. We did an amphibious assault. So if you've seen any kind of D-Day movie with the landing craft, it was identical to that. It's an open landing craft and with a bay door that goes down in the front when you hit the beach and you run off to the beach. And so we are all in line, these boats, and we're headed to the beach, and there's, you know, blanks being shot from 50 caliber machine guns to simulate the noise. And I'm thinking of this in Technicolor because I've only ever seen it in black and white. And I thought to myself as we're approaching and we hit the sandbar and eventually had to swim in February. I don't see a sign on the beach that says ladies to the right and gentlemen to the left. We're all going to go to the same place. And I don't know who's on the other side of that ridge. So I had decided to convert, but I wasn't yet converted. I didn't commit to going to Mass. I was still going back and forth between my Protestant church, and then I'd go to Mass. I went to the Protestant church, I'd go to Mass because I had a lot of friends, and I wasn't brave enough to say this is it. But one day in November, I was driving down the highway, and I drove right past the exit to the Naval Academy. I drove straight to the St. Athanasius Church. There was a priest there. It was a friend of the society who was saying Mass there, and that was it. And I asked for instructions. That was November. But at the end of this 6 months of training, I had to choose my occupational specialty. I did have the flight billet. I was going to go to pilot school. But that was going to be 8 years of commitment. And at this point, I knew I have to get out sooner than that. I had to give up the flight billet. So I went to my chain of command. I said, I need to give up this flight billet. I don't believe in women in combat anymore. And thankfully, the platoon commander and the commanding officer agreed with me. When I got to the executive officer, he says, I don't understand what you're saying. I don't have a problem with it. I spoke to him for 2 hours. I tried, you know, and I don't know anything myself yet. But I tried to explain it to him. And I don't really know that I got it myself. I just knew that I can't do this. This is not right. And so I had to tell the officer who helped me get the billet. Thankfully, he just laughed. And I had to tell my father, who I knew would be devastated. And he was. Incredibly, years later, I found out that neither my father nor my mother believed that women should be in combat. I said, why didn't you say something? I said, well, you wanted to do it. You thought you could do it. We didn't want to stop you. So I made a list of what occupational specialty I wanted. I had no idea. I didn't ever pay attention to any of those briefs because I was going to be a pilot and I didn't care. And I wrote computers at the top. Well, maybe I can get a good job later on. And I wrote down the bottom, very, very bottom, communications officer, radio communications. And the time came and they called out my name. They said, communications. I mean, I'd like to tell you I walked out of that conversation having dropped this flight billet, skipping through the air and, you know, being very joyful and at peace. And I was depressed. My dream was gone. Okay. It was gone. And now I have a communications officer because I didn't know they combined the computer that was at the top and the radio that was the bottom. They were combined now and it was all one occupational specialty. And the worst of it all was the school was 6 months long and it was in Quantico. So I was still going to be in Virginia. And I didn't realize until I was writing this speech, the hand of God, because nowhere else would I have been able to finish my instruction and be baptized. But here, I finished my instruction and I was baptized before I went out into the fleet. And so the day before my baptism, we had a bus trip to Paris Island and I was reading my catechism. I said, well, okay, now I have to start obeying the Ten Commandments. This is it. I mean, I got to do this now. I have to take this seriously. Do I really want to do this? Yes. For confirmation, which was some months later, I chose Catherine of Siena. I liked her because she told off the Pope. And I asked the priest, I said, are there any more Dominicans? He said, yes, in fact, there are some in Idaho. All right. Well, I drove out to my duty station and I put my gear in a bachelor officer quarter room and I flew up to Idaho. And my first exposure to sisters, they were incredible. And I said, these women, and I'm a kind of a city kid, sort of, and they're out in kind of what I thought was maybe the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And they're at this school teaching these girls and they gave themselves to God. Oh, I want to do this. I got to do this. Got to do this. And I went home and I was so excited. I told my family. Yeah. A word to the wise girls. Sorry. If you think you have a vocation, start off with it being between you, the priest, and the superior of the order. And when they say it's time, bring it up with your family. Just take my word for it. So I was living in Southern California at this point. You know, Hollywood, the home of the Rome of the materialist world. Okay. And, but I started on the general staff and we had to do a field exercise. And in this exercise, there was a detachment that had to go forward and a little bit closer to the enemy lines. And because I'm the junior officer, I was supposed to be in this detachment. And the men were absolutely at their wit's end with what to do. They were upset. Oh, you take her. No. I can't take her. No, you're going to take her. No, she should go. No, you're right. No, you're right. She shouldn't go. We should put her over here. No, take her. I think, you know, I'm okay. I can do this. It's okay. I can go. This is a field exercise. And they want to protect me from what could happen. And why do I want to make them not do that just so that I can fulfill my dream of living dangerously? The first time I wore a skirt was right about now. Okay, took a while to get there. That was an up and down experience the whole time, but I did wear a skirt and it was raining. And in California, I guess a lot of the gas stations don't have covers over them. So I went out to pump my gas and a man came literally sprinting out of the gas station. Oh, miss, I'll pump your gas. Get back in your car. I'll pump your gas for you. And I handed him the pump and I got in the car. And I thought, this is power. I went to Naval Academy for 4 years to command and all I had to do was wear a skirt. The men did notice. Man, we're going to go on a ski exercise. We're going to go on a ski trip. You're going to wear a skirt? Ha, ha, ha. I had to learn very early on, if I was teased brutally, I was in. That's how men operate. I didn't get that. And I had to learn that if you're accepted in a male group, it's because they're teasing you mercilessly. So later on, a gunnery sergeant even told me, one time, "Ma'am, those are the ugliest shoes I've ever seen in my life." Thank you, Gunny. Thank you. All right. And I was then transferred to another unit where I was the platoon commander. And I couldn't really be one with the guys. You know, I had maybe 50 Marines that there was this distance. And I really didn't get what I was supposed to do anyway. This was, I didn't quite get where I was supposed to draw the line and what I was supposed to do. Well, we almost deployed. And I was told at the meeting that I was going to be the company commander of the rear element. In other words, I was going to stay at the base and be the company commander. "You're going to take my Marines to combat without me?" "Yeah." "Oh." And I did make a decision to give up rock music for Lent. And silence is very hard because I had to face myself. And but I found that that was one of the best things I could have done. I did start cheating later and listening to country music, which I don't care what anybody says, it's no different. thankfully, it was easier for me to make the switch because I loved classical music. And that I contributed to my mother because that's all we listened to at home. And also some big band that was dead. I visited Browerville, and I was in the peak condition at this point, physical condition, and they knelt for an entire hour, for a holy hour. And I'm in the back squirming. Oh, my knees are killing me. And they're just... And I thought, I would really like to see a Marine Corps Recon Ranger come here and do a holy hour with the Browerville sisters and see if they can hack it. Then I was transferred to 29 Palms, where I met the Deisters. And I was in charge of the school of the radio operators, so the entry-level radio operators. They get in with boot camp, and they go there, and they get their training, and the telephone wiremen. And after about a month, I stopped saying, "Now I've seen everything." It is really amazing the creativity that mankind can use to offend God. And there were, I had at the time I was there, two instructors court-martialed for inappropriate relationships with their students. There was a student who was court-martialed for assaulting a student, female student. Those are the ones we caught. And the barracks, it's 29 Palms, it's the desert, there's nothing to do. Okay, and the women are up on the third floor, and they were 18 years old, and they're getting a lot of attention. It's just human nature. They were vulnerable because it's their first time away from home, and they're young, and somebody thinks that they're attractive, and they just don't get it. I did hear, however, come to appreciate that men are so objective. I had some trouble with a Marine, and I went to my commanding officer's office, and I said, "Sir, I have some trouble." And of course, I wanted to talk about it, and I start talking about it. And he says, "Lieutenant, what is the problem?" "Sir, A, B, C. But this is what you need to do." And I was astonished. And it wasn't really because he was older and more experienced. It was because he was a man. And I, from that point on, really appreciated a man's ability to cut through the... and just be very objective, to cut through all the nonsense and be objective. Well, later on, he said, "Lieutenant, we're having a retirement party. And Master Gunnery Sergeant so-and-so is retiring. And would you please arrange that?" I said, "Okay, sir. Well, I think we'll get some flowers for his wife, if that's all right. And we'll get a cake. And... I can't remember, we'll do something for this ceremony." He says, "Wow. Oh, I knew I did the right thing by having a woman be in charge of this." So what? I had a student then who shaved her head. That she, I don't know, I hope you've not seen the movie that was about Navy SEALs with I can't remember the actress named Demi Moore. Okay, but that's how short it was. And my gunnery sergeant came in, "Ma'am, she shaved her head. One of my students shaved her head. You've got to talk to her." "Gunny, she's your student. You talk to her." No, I can't. You have to talk to her." This is my most loyal gunnery sergeant, the one who told me I had ugly shoes. Okay. Okay. All right. Bring her in. She comes in, and I'm just trying to hold still. We weren't supposed to have at that time, I don't know what it's like now, eccentric haircuts were out. And this is eccentric because it's very, very short. And I said, "Marine, this is not an appropriate haircut for women." And she just blinked at me and said, "But ma'am, I'm here to be a Marine. I should shave my head like everyone does." "Well, it's the logic, isn't it?" it's logic. And the thing is, when I got out, they stopped issuing skirts to women. And I just looked online and found out that the young women are now wearing the men's blue uniform. And at the time, when I got out, for the first time, I saw a female officer go to the Marine Corps ball. So this is black tie, okay, gowns and tuxedo equivalent. A woman went to the Marine Corps ball in trousers. The shoes are now exactly like the men's shoes, because I asked for a retired Air Force staff sergeant to pick us up a pair of shoes, because the way I remember them is they looked like the nun's shoes of old. They had a little seam on the top and they were just like the nuns wore. And I thought, maybe we could finally find black shoes for cheap. And when I opened them up, they looked just like the men's shoes. And I watched a little video, and it was the first graduation from boot camp with these blues. Now, it used to be just the honor graduate got to wear them. Okay. And the recruit was about to graduate. She said, now there are no women Marines and men Marines. There are only Marines. Oh boy. And we didn't want that. Nobody wants that. And it's interesting, if we really are the same, which was the mantra, you're the same except for a few physical differences. You're the same except for a few physical differences. But if we really are the same, well, they also eliminate those differences in the physical tests the men should really have to pass. But that wasn't really the main issue. What was the problem? It's a Chesterton quote, and I don't have the exact thing, but I think this is about right. A man fights not so much because of what is in front of him, but because of what is behind him. And if we're there right next to him, what is he fighting for? It's impossible for men and women to work side by side, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in high-pressure situations without developing an emotional attachment of some kind. And most of the time, it's dangerous. And if somebody thinks that they're immune, they don't know themselves. Every military woman I ever met who was married to a military man. And most, or I would say significant number, if not most, of those relationships started off, quote unquote, illegally, the same chain of command, or too much of a difference in rank. Okay, it's not good for good order and discipline. And I really saw the Marine Corps as the last bastion of male honor that was left. And we all know men act differently when they're by themselves in a group. And when one woman is introduced into that group, the entire group dynamic changes. It's different. So I felt that I had to cut off the womanly part. It was partly a protection. Now, it was easier for me to protect myself because I could go home I didn't live in the barracks. So I could go home in the apartment at night. Okay. But I had to kind of turn into a machine. And I was a machine. And I felt at that point that I was a part of a big social experiment that had failed, that was failing, and that was being pushed. We had a major who proposed the uniform change already then. That was over 20 years ago. And I brought it to my master sergeant, very competent master sergeant. I closed the door and I said to her, what do you think of this? She said, I can't believe it. This is what they're going to do to us. They're going to make us the men. And I'm thinking, well, what did we expect? But we didn't want that. It's not what we wanted. So I was just about to get out, and I was thinking of going on a pilgrimage to Lourdes, to France, which included a pilgrimage to Lourdes. And it was my last time on the rifle range, and I just tell the story so that you know that God even works through our vanity. I had always shot expert from the time I was a midshipman until now. I had always shot expert in rifle and pistol. And there is a close, middle, and far line to shoot from to get your qualification that you had to do every year. And I was on the close line, and I shot out of the target. I shot again out of the target. And this went on. And I'm not kidding. I said to the Blessed Mother, all right, I know I've been thinking about this pilgrimage. If you let me keep my expert badge, I will go. And when I get to Lourdes, I'm going to give you a rose. 300-yard line. I had a beautiful group of very tight shots, completely out of the target. Next, you know, seated, out of the target. I'm on the last faraway line. There are 10 shots. One, out of the target. Now I'm thinking, am I going to see that the expert badge is really pretty. And because I didn't deploy, and I made conscious decision, I had some invitations and I refused them the deployment because I was afraid of being away from mass for too long. So I didn't have that big fancy rack of ribbons that most of the Marines have at this point. I had like a couple little beanie things there. So I wanted those expert badges. Okay, vanity. All right, I'm not lying, vanity. Number three, out of the target. I think number four or five, maybe I hit the target. At shot number 8 out of 10, cease fire. Step off the line. So we all get up and we're thinking, okay, what's going on? It was a bad batch of ammunition. A bullet had struck the target. It had dropped. So the Marines stand with their back to the shooters and they pull the targets down. And I don't know how it is now, but that's how they used to do it. They pull the targets down, they mark them, and they put the targets back up. Well, it struck the target and it went down the shirt of the Marine and it burned the Marine. Now, I continue to pray for this Marine every day. It wasn't seriously burned, but he did get a burn and it didn't count. So I kept my expert badge. Okay, that's how she wanted to do it. Intercession. So now I thought, oh boy, I have to go on a pilgrimage. And that's where I met Midge Hanrahan on the pilgrimage. And the first stop was to see the body of St. Vincent de Paul. And I said, who's that? I met St. Vincent de Paul. That's him? It's a wax effigy. I flew all the way to France to look at wax. No, there's bones in there. Okay. People, why are you touching your, what are you touching? Why are you kissing the glass? It's a little weird. Why are you kissing the glass? I don't get this. I didn't know what he did. I knew nothing. I'd been reading my catechism. I did not read much of the lives of the saints. Okay, there was a Saint Teresa. I didn't know which one. I know there's two. I was completely confused about Teresa's. It was a little flower. Okay, they told me it's the little flower. Okay, the little flower. But what struck me again, and I was told in ninth grade that Jesus Christ was a real person, and that was astonishing to me. And what came back to me here was, you can say that they're not saints, but you can't say they didn't exist. Like, you know, I would say God didn't exist, so therefore the saints didn't exist, and St. Peter didn't exist, and these people didn't exist, but there's their house. There's the desk that they sat at. There's this wax thing with the bones in it. And then we went to Lourdes. And not only did I help Midge find her credit card, but they told me we were going to do these baths. And I said, baths? Yeah, we're going to get dunked in water and you're going to come up. What? Yeah, this is going to be great. And you'll come out and feel dry. Well, I some of you may know, I have pretty bad food allergies. I said, all right, how about the food allergies? I'm going to cure the food allergies. So we go in these baths and I come out. I was a believer. I can't tell you the sense of peace. And I was dry. And I think sometimes now the cures at Lourdes are spiritual, not always physical. And I thought, you know, when people stopped going to Lourdes, we're in big trouble because it was just crowded with people. But when I got there, I thought, where am I going to get a rose? I'm going to give her a rose. Well, it's Lourdes. There are roses everywhere, and they're all wrapped in plastic very neatly. So I could buy one, and I went to the procession, and very unceremoniously, because you can't stop, I hurled it at the statue and it went end over end and landed at her feet. I thought, I hope that's going to do. So I had two proposals at the end of my career. I had a lucrative job proposal and a marriage proposal. And both of these I declined because I knew I had to try a vocation. I had to do it. So I went to Post Falls and I remembered the first time I giggled. I was used to sort of, ha, ha, ha. And it was very liberating. And I said, you know, I am a liberated woman. I am liberated to be a woman. And it was an all-girls school. I used to feel sorry for the girls at all-girls school, but this was incredible. And I learned more in that 12th grade class in philosophy than I ever learned at college. And in 2002, my friend Barbara, who was I knew from California, had joined the Franciscans, and so I went to see them. And so I went to visit this farmhouse, and then there was this other farmhouse. They're living in two farmhouses, and there was an old priest with a kind of a broken back, and this little old lady, Mother Herlinda, 92 years old, sitting on the couch. She could barely sit up. And I thought, this is hopeless. Sign me up. It has to be the work of God. And it is. I believe it. That we shouldn't exist, and we do. Thanks be to God. And, you know, I figured, okay, now I'm a sister. I won't be around men anymore. Well, God has a sense of humor because now I run the maintenance for the convent, and I have contractors, and I am interacting with men all the time. And that's okay. I think maybe that's part of the reason he led me down the path he did, because I helped to understand them a little bit better. But my conversion continues. And for any faithful Catholic, each moment of life brings an opportunity for conversion. And we know that it's kind of awful out there. And the world's being turned on its ear by the forces of evil. And we always ask, what can we do? Well, we as women, we have the power. We can do something, and we can do something about ourselves. Our own attitudes toward the things of the world, to see them as the dust that they are. Our own striving for daily conversion. That's what inspires others to follow. If we do it, and we can be instruments of change to bring other people to Christ. So let us seize those moments and renew our confidence in God and press on to the end. Our Lady of Ransom, Our Lady of Lourdes, pray for us. Thank you.